Thank you, Father Lorenzo. Well, Father Filippo joked before lunch that I'm being reserved for dessert. But actually, I think the real reason is they don't want you to lose your appetite during after my presentation, if it were before lunch. But anyway, first of all, I'd like to thank CSER for allowing me this opportunity to make this short presentation on Asian migration research. Secondly, to Father Graciano for inviting me over to
Rome.
Okay, he just entered the room. My presentation is divided into two parts. The first part is a bit short, and it will be on the state of Asian migration, which I'm sure is not lost to most people in the
C'è qualcuno che ha l'audio acceso senza auricolari? No, è lì arriva il conflitto, ma è in sala perché non c'è più il computer, la televisione da sola non può parlare. Ok?
Okay, thank you. And the second part, I will try to answer the guide questions that were posed by Father Graziano, one after the other. So, first off, if I may provide you with a general overview of the Asian migration situation, arguably, Asia has been changed by migration in more ways than one. Asia is now richer, more prosperous, more competitive, and more resilient because of migration. It's hard to imagine Asia without, the phenomenon having a huge impact on it. But that's not to say that everything is, well and good. There continue to be challenges and difficulties for governments, for societies and communities, and most importantly for the migrants themselves, especially those who are doing heavy, difficult, low-skilled and household work in certain parts of the region. The scale of migration from and within Asia is largely what drives the global phenomenon of migration altogether. In terms of magnitude, the stock of international migrants coming from the region, coming from Asia, is the largest of any other single global region. 4 in 10 international migrants in the world today are from Asia. Around 1 in 3 of the migrant workers, 169 million migrant workers in the world today, are from the region. Nearly two-thirds of Asian migration, this is another peculiarity in terms of the regional migration context, nearly two-thirds of the Asian migration that's happening is within the continent itself. Most notably, going to West Asia, East Asia, with the migrants coming from South and Southeast Asia. Having said that, I mean, I think it's impossible to single-handedly capture the Asian migration dynamic. And so let me just give you some of the highlights of the state of migration before I attempt to tackle the state of Asian migration research. Receiving countries have been profoundly, I mean, It's safe to assume that, receiving countries have been profoundly affected by the influx of these migrants. In certain cases, in the Gulf in particular, foreign migrants make up the majority of the population.
See?
And this has led to various social issues arising within these receiving societies. The peculiarity of temporary migration, particularly labor migration in Asia, is the embeddedness of migrant precarity and the loss of agency for the migrants themselves. Whether one talks about the employers of the foreign migrants or their governments, it's always the case that somebody is speaking for them. And the recent COVID-19 pandemic made these issues and challenges actually even more evident, as many migrants either lost their jobs due to the lockdown and were sent home, or worse, were blamed for the pandemic. Countries of origin have likewise been economically, socially, and demographically transformed by migration. Every year, you have billions of dollars of income remittances being sent home by millions of Asian migrants back to their home countries, transforming their home economies in the process. But in my view, migrant remittances, although there is definitely contention here, migrant remittances act a bit like steroids and painkillers, you know. They give you a sense of power. They give you a sense of relief in terms of alleviating poverty and enhancing with the growth of your local market. But over the long term, these can have serious side effects. Demographically, not only are the receiving countries experiencing an aging kind of population, but it's also happening in some sending countries as well. For instance, in the Philippines, in 2010, migrants below 35 years of age made up nearly half. This was back in 2010, made up nearly half, 49.7 of total migrant workers from the country. By 2022, a dozen years later, this had gone down to 40%. And those aged 40 and above rose to 39%, almost 40%. So this has serious implications for countries of origin because you have more and more migrants who are now growing older in the host countries. They are returning as migrants. We're also now starting to see migrant workers bring their families with them, particularly in some Asian regions that are now relaxing their regulations on the entry of migrants. But do take note that this does not really mean integration in the sense of granting citizenship to migrants. As far as Asia is concerned, labor migration really is the key marker for the region. Migrants in destination areas are typically employed on a contractual basis to do low-paying, low-skilled, and semi-skilled jobs that locals prefer not to do. And so labor migration in Asia is usually channeled through a burgeoning private recruitment and brokering industry, and less through government-to-government channels. In some ways, you have government re regulations acting as a kind of rescue system for the migrants, because you have regulations that, I mean, at least try to convey a protective measure, especially for the so-called vulnerable migrant groups, particularly women. And speaking of women, since the 1990s, we're seeing a growing number of women migrants working abroad as caregivers, nurses, domestic workers, and even sales workers. Despite established policies in the region, irregular migration continues. It's quite common in the region, especially in mainland Southeast Asia and parts of South Asia. Bilateral government-to-government arrangements are seen to be a means to addressing these challenges, these issues that are facing the migrants and also their authorities to manage migration, but these are difficult to undertake. And since the early 2000s, we've seen multilateral and multi-stakeholder dialogues and consultation arrangements that are not as formal. They are, in fact, informal and non-legally binding. And so, turning now to the guide questions that have been posed. Well, definitely the field of Asian migration research holds immense importance due to the region's dynamic and complex migration patterns and practices, as I just discussed briefly. And so I will tackle the questions one at a time and give my answer. First question, what's the state of scholarship and knowledge production in the field of Asian migration? Because I have had limited time to write up the paper for this, I used some existing mapping surveys that have already been published. And I should also note here that any mapping survey of scholarly products should be taken with a grain of salt. And these mapping surveys are bound to have geographical and even linguistic limitations. In the last few years, we've seen mapping surveys of knowledge products on migration in general, looking at published migration-related articles, published migration-related topics. Also, they do a word search. And also, there's even one that looks at the most influential works in the field of migration. Even though contemporary migration in and from the region is quite substantial, okay, not much has been reflected in these mapping surveys as far as research on Asian migration is concerned. For example, a survey done of published articles between 1974 and 2018 was able to collect over 48,000 materials just from the journals, okay? And it showed Asia to have just around 1,944 materials of published output, no? Compared to North America, which has over 14,700 published articles, and of course Europe, which has over 13,500. Despite this, and since the early 2000s, however, scholars on Asian migration have also done their own self-reflections on doing research in the field, as well as linking Asian migration scholarship with the wider field of global migration research, and even inquiring into the impact of migration research on migration policy, as well as re-examining some of these institutional initiatives that are being undertaken in the Asian region. So it's quite substantial, but you wonder why it's not as acknowledged, as in the field, as field of migration in general, especially from the West. Second question, what research directions or trajectories have been taken by Asian migration researchers? What major issues and questions have received attention from the experts in the field? Safe to say that Asian migration research has certainly contributed to the global migration discourse, although much still needs to be done in the area of theorizing in the field. In fact, Father Graciano mentioned this morning and yesterday as well. Much of the knowledge products that have been produced about Asian migration are indeed empirically grounded, but that's pretty much it. They're pretty much descriptive. Secondly, since the 1970s at least, much of the empirical research done revolved around labor migration and the role of the state, the precarity of the migrants, gender and migration, especially women in migration, the role of migration intermediaries, and more recently, questions of diaspora making and of making the temporary more permanent. There are definitely gaps. There is not much work. There is work done, but not as much as the other parts of the region. When one talks about Central Asia or even South Asia. And since the 1990s and even earlier, this is sort of my own personal interest, Asian migration scholars, particularly mostly economists, have had to grapple with the challenge of the question of migration transition. How do countries of origin become countries of destination? So far, the only example that we can make of in the case of Asia would be South Korea. For several decades now, as well, researchers on Asian migrants have also had to struggle with the difficulty of obtaining and sharing reliable, comparable, and up-to-date migration data across countries in our vast region. As early as 1995, for example, the Philippines recognized the necessity of having a shared government information system on migration. But up to now, and nearly three decades later, this has remained an unfulfilled idea. So while scholars do recognize the vital role that migration data plays, and even policymakers, but apparently the latter don't seem to want to do anything about it. I raise here further questions drawing from Father Graciano's edited volume back in 2014. The first question has to do with the push-pull theory, which is a rather dominant theoretical perspective when it comes to migration. But the reality in Asia is that more and more migrants are receiving lower and lower salaries, and yet people still move. And so the question now is, at what point do you draw? Where is now the threshold? Where is now the line where you will say, I mean, economists, usually, no offense to the economists in the room, but the economists are usually prone to making these kinds of predictions. You know, if you achieve equilibrium, and that's going to, and if as long as that equilibrium is not met, you're not going to see an end to migration. But trouble is, we're seeing migrants from Sri Lanka, for example, getting less than $100 a month as a salary, and yet they still move. And speaking of female labor migration, why is female labor migration more pronounced in some countries like Indonesia, the Philippines, and even Sri Lanka, but not in other migrant-sending countries from Asia? Does this mean some countries are more feminized than others? What factors might cause migrants to return for good? Again, what we're seeing is a step migration. People might move to, let's say, the Gulf, and then they move somewhere else instead of going back to, let's say, Indonesia or even the Philippines. Why do some migrants choose even to stay at their destinations, even during a crisis? there would be instances where government would offer, you know, a free ride back home, and yet few migrants would take that opportunity. Why? They choose to stay in precarity. They choose to stay facing those kinds of dangers abroad. And what explains their desire to move to other sites? To what extent can temporary migration function properly without introducing the possibility of permanent settlement? In the Gulf, that seems to be the case. It's a sort of permanent impermanence where you have migrants staying there for long periods of time as if they're from there, and yet they're not. And more importantly, how can migrants be provided with a greater sense of agency, a greater sense of voice? And I think this is where this group in particular can play a role, giving the migrants a sense of their own voice, a sense of their own agency in negotiating for their own protection, and not have somebody else protect them in their behalf. Another question that was raised is, to what extent have the scholarly outputs been utilized by policymakers? Well, a few things need to be said here about the issue of migration policies, in general, at least. The more you control it, the more it's going to be out of control, basically. The more you're going to get, the more you strive for absolute control of migration, the more it's going to get out of hand. So this, again, raises another question. Is it desirable to even want to institute this kind of, I'm talking about absolute control. There's probably a difference between managing migration but somehow policymakers seem to equate one with the other. Managing is controlling migration. Overly restrictive policies actually can lead to higher instances of irregular migration. Another thing about controlling migration is that, it doesn't matter what regime type, you have. There is always, and I think this is where the Asian experience also has certain common ground with the European experience as well. There's always this need to stem the flow, the tide of migration, the inflow at least. And then the last thing about migration policies, that they tend to lack coherence. They lack coherence at best. At worst, you're talking about a disconnect between policy in the letter and policy in actual practice and reality. Now, as far as migration research leading to migration policy is concerned, an early 2000s assessment gave a rather nuanced view of the state of migration research utilization and policy in the region. Different countries will appreciate migration research. Some will appreciate research more, others not so much. No? But what it was found to be some common ground for this study was that research would have a greater impact on policy when it is initiated in partnership with government. Or better yet, when government commissions. No, but that then again raises the question of what sort of agenda should researchers have? Should they just comply with what is being told to them by those in authority? In any case, migration policymakers are more likely to be swayed by public opinion rather than evidence-based research. And this is true, again, in the other regions. So one strategy that could be suggested here is for migration scholars to try to disseminate and popularize their findings. I'm not saying it's not being done now. It's being done. But the idea here is to participate in the wider conversation and not just reach out to your fellow scholars or even to policymakers, because at the end of the day, the policymakers are going to listen to their constituents. And so it's better to reach out to the constituents rather than just the policymakers. What research institutes are involved in migration studies in the Asian region? Okay. A recent survey of migration research institutions, MRIs, observed that there continue to be organizations and networks in Asia, although not to the extent that these institutions exist in the other regions, particularly in Europe and the America, North America, rather. They're still outnumbered in these regions. Between 1945 and 2020, there was a directory that was done of 280 research institutions that ever existed during that period. Of course, the researchers couldn't tell whether these institutions are still, you know, around, but they recorded it into a directory of different institutions. And of this number, 280, 17 are in East, Southeast, and South Asia. Only 17. 14 are in West Asia. So a couple of dozen institutions in the region that pretty much defines global migration. And like I said, it's hard to say whether these institutions are still operating today. What is clear is that if there used to be a region-wide research network that existed back in the mid-90s up to maybe the early 2000s. But it's very difficult to sustain this kind of network, regional network, if you don't have funds, if you don't have an institutional base, maybe like a university. And so it's very difficult to, not just to manage this kind of network, but really to make it sustainable. But in this particular directory, nearly all the Asian institutions are based with academic institutions. So that tells you something, that you have to have a firm grounding with funds if you want to establish a working, sustainable research network in the region. What migration research directions can we put forward for the region? This is certainly not exhaustive, but there have been a lot of developments, okay, even in the last decade. Okay, you have COVID, for example. And so now an emerging research area would be the attention given by scholars to the health-related concerns of migrant workers, including maybe even their mental health issues. Because this migration health nexus really needs more further examination, deeper examination, more serious and thorough examination, because this is not definitely going to be the last time that we will have a crisis of this magnitude happening in the region. Within the last decade or so, I'm not sure if this was mentioned in the previous regions, but in Asia, we're a huge consumer of the internet, user of the internet, information technology. And so we find that new modalities are emerging for migrants to be recruited, to identify destinations, you know, through social media platforms. Like Facebook, YouTube, TikTok. You don't have to go to a travel agency. All you need to do is go to an influencer on the internet. And he or she will provide you all the details that you would want. How to get there, what visa to apply for, what documents to show, and things like that. And so the interface between labor migration and information technology certainly merits attention. Enough for, I think, IUN to do a study, an initial mapping of this phenomenon for Asian women migrants and their use of the cell phone. Asian migration researchers must also recognize the policy significance of their knowledge products. It's important that we reach out to policymakers and also, most importantly, the public at large. We convince the public, not just, I mean, but of course, it's easier said than done, okay? Because the public will definitely have their own assumptions and biases about what they think about migration and the migrants. But it should not stop us from participating in this wider conversation, especially not just with policymakers, but also civil society groups, CSOs. It's time that this migration research, migration policy nexus be on our agenda. What are the long-term prospects of migration for ascending country like the Philippines? We've been at it for 50 years, half a century, and yet we still call it temporary labor migration. Is there a, should there be a new discourse now when it comes to looking at the future of temporary migration to actually become permanent? Labor migration from the Philippines, like I said, was originally conceived as a stopgap. No? So not to phase out migration completely, but rather to look, to re-examine the transition again. I think we should bring that back on the table, put that back on the table, the question of research transition, rather, migration transition. There are new areas we now see, because of the pandemic, we now see what they call gig workers, people who drive like their Uber taxis or do deliveries. You know, they're migrants, especially in the Gulf. So what's happening? How is the migration phenomenon unfolding given these new trends of information technology and the pandemic? And definitely, to echo Father Graciano's point, we need to move away from descriptive and repetitive research towards more comparative and theory building, theory contributing research. So thank you very much.